Somehow in this world, things wasn't working my way, but I kept on walking down the street and I saw this little girl that somehow appeared to me. Looking at this girl, I don't know why, but just made me feel like I feel something inside. I just wanted to keep on walking and talking. But look, as I was walking down the street, it just somehow I couldn't look back. Something about that young lady that just, I don't know what trained my back. Thinking about being why I was wanting to be, I just looked back, saw the girl that she was looking at me, and I, oh, I'd like to know, baby. I feel so guilty because of the thing that crossed my mind. I didn't want to go back where I was starting from because it was past that girl's mind again. I left her on that stone. My mind changed, I don't know why. Destiny just didn't feel the same no more. Didn't feel it. Ah! Sometimes needed a woman to talk to. Couldn't chat myself. That woman was just like something happened in my yeah. Look back again, and I saw somebody drive up. Big black Cadillac, tuck. Ah! Yeah, y'all know what I'm talking about. Yeah. I'll say this to you again. I don't want to see. I hate. If I had to look back, see those same things again. How? Baby! You know what I'm talking about, don't you, fellas? When you meet someone, ha, pretty, thank you, bye. Think about double barrel act, shotgun, when they drive on, and big Cadillac, you know, on walking on your feet, you can't. Just can't go.
Hey, welcome with Mr. James. Mr. James Norton and the Mike Hightower Band. Yes, sir. It's time, Jeannie.
It's time for what?
It's time for...
No, not bluepower.com.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
I think I hear my music coming, my people.
Roll it. Time for the Blue Tower. You know what? I'm
yeah, you're into
top.
Mike Hightower. It's,
yeah.
It's Blue Power.
BluePower.com, and that's what we got to say from now on, right,
uh-huh.
Jeannie?
Well, that's what you're trying to train me to say.
I know. Just training a seal. You understand?
I'm Jeannie C.
And I'm John R. And guess what?
what?
We have one of the world's finest producers, one of the original men of the record business, Mr. Harry Balk, with us today, and we're very, very, very pleased to have him here.
Now, you are going to explain at some point during this show?
Yeah. What do you want me to explain?
I would like to know all about this wonderful man's history.
Well, we have him here, and that's why we have him, so we are edified.
We'll be edified and edumacated. Here we go.
Absolutely. Little Willie John and Fever. Welcome, Harry Balk. Good to see you, my friend.
Nice being here, John.
Damn, man. Been smoking a lot of them cigars lately, haven't you?
Well, I got a little laryngitis, but that's kind of all the time right now.
Harry and I have known each other since, I think, 1965, was it? 65.
You're giving away our age.
I know, that's over 25 years, folks, for those of us who are mathematically challenged.
And
that's a quarter of a century.
That's a long time.
It's even longer in dog years.
Yeah. 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 Okay. And Harry, I had heard of Harry long before I met him. He's like one of the guys, one of the originals. And we're very, very proud to have you here today, Harry, on BluePower.com. We just heard a record by Little Willie John. And what did you have to do with Little Willie John?
Well, I owned some black theaters in the black neighborhoods of Detroit, and we had slow nights, like on a Thursday or a Tuesday, and I decided to put amateur shows in there. And this Homer Jones put together the things, and so we put on the shows, and Little Willie John kept winning practically every week. Anyway, I saw some. I knew nothing about, you know, the entertainment business.
You were a promoter, in other words, right? I mean, basically.
Well, basically, I ran movie houses. It was a movie house.
Okay.
And what I did is I put in, you know, I used to run, like, Marijuana Madness and that type of thing on a Thursday.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah, I did. Anything to bring people
my.
In.
Oh, my.
Excuse me.
I still believe that. I still believe that to this day. That movie is absolutely 100% correct in its depiction of Reefer Madness. Don't you agree, fellas?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you ran it. You were a repeat offender.
And, I mean, exploitation pictures anyway. Mm-hmm. And just, we did okay. And then this Homer Jones approached me, and I said, sure, let's give it a shot. And, I mean, we'd have lines around the block. It just unbelievable our business picked up on that particular night. And then from there, most theaters in black neighborhoods started amateur shows. But I saw Willie, and I was smoking cigars then, and I walked up to him and said, kid, I'm going to make you a big star. Just sign with me. Well, he was 15 or 16, I think, and we had to go through, you know.
Did you really say that, kid, I'm going to make you a big star?
Absolutely. Is that corny or what?
You know, I'm still waiting for somebody to say that to me.
But anyway, so I signed him, and, you know, we went through the courts. His father was his guardian, and that's how I discovered Willie.
And were you instrumental in getting him signed to King?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you do his first demo, and how did...
I did not produce Willie. Henry Glover was the one who produced...
great man.
Great. Talented guy. He created most of the hits on King Records. You know, Hank Ballard. Yeah. You know, he was great.
He was a great writer as well.
Excuse me. Yes, he was. He was. He's a terrific guy. Nice guy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we went down to Cincinnati, and you know, Willie recorded, and I knew nothing about recording, but I kept telling him, you know, the sax was doing one thing, somebody else was doing something, and I kept telling Henry, hey, why don't you have the sax do this? And he looked at me like I was nuts, you know. But 15 minutes later, the sax was doing something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the next time Willie had a record after a hit, Henry used to tell Sid Nathan, who owned King Records, he said, make sure that his manager, you know, that guy is with him.
His input is valuable.
Yeah, so...
That's called beginner's luck, by the way.
Absolutely. So then, you know, I saw what Henry was doing. I said, well, Helen, you know, I can do that.
Yeah.
I went to a studio in Detroit, Fortune Records. They had, like, a little storefront with nothing there but a control board. And so I'm doing my first session.
And in those days, were they just they were only using four tracks, right? Or two?
No,
recording straight to stereo?
No.
Or
No,
we're cutting live, two tracks.
Just two tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, not even two.
Mono.
Mono.
300 Ampex, I bet you.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Anyway, you know, and I knew nothing about faders, bringing them up and down and stuff. And I kept telling this drummer, hit the drum harder. Harder, keep hitting it harder. Anyway, he put a hole in his snare.
Well, I'm sure
next thing I
you.
Knew, he packed up his drums, and here I am. That was my first session.
Uh-huh.
So how long were you with Willie John?
Well, you know, with Willie, I was with him. I had a contract, like a six-year contract, I think, or seven. I don't remember exactly, but, excuse me. With Willie... he was kind of a problem child on the road. I mean, always in problems, always shooting up a damn hotel room or
where
something.
Where would he get access to the guns?
Well, I don't know, you know, but there was all... I knew every bondsman from Detroit to Plum Nelly, okay? And so I did about 3 years with Willie, and I had... but his father was a little difficult to do business with, too, you know, then... And I had about three more years to go on him, and we were making some big bucks with them, too. And I just said, hey, forget it. You know, the aggravation is just not worth it. And so I turned it loose. And that was my thing with Willie.
My God.
Was that the record that you were able to produce for $60?
No.
No?
No, that's coming up.
Is that
that's
coming up? I'm jumping ahead of this. Harry told me this incredible story that I'm still very incredulous of, the fact that one of the first productions, the first records that he made cost him $60.
Who was that for?
Johnny and the Hurricanes.
Johnny and the Hurricanes, my God. Red River Rock?
No.
What was the first one?
It was Crossfire.
Crossfire. That was the first big hit they had.
Yeah, it was a guitar thing.
Guitar records were pretty popular. Dwayne Eddy and
it started after the Hurricanes. Yeah. Guitar records were, and then of course Bill Black.
Right, Bill Black combo.
The little organ thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then we did. But the thing is, it cost me $60. I had a friend of mine. I had the Carmen Theater. And he had like a little studio, you know, he had a studio up there. And we cut the thing, and so my partner and I, Irv McConnick, we said, well, let's go to New York. I mean, you know, we got a hit, let's go to New York. So we went to New York, I saw Mitch Miller, I saw these people. Everybody turned it down. He said, well, this is a joke, you know. Now here we're coming back in this old beat-up car. Uh-huh. And I said, Irv, how much does it cost to put out a record? And he's, well, I don't know. You know, let's check it out. Anyway, that's where our big expenses came in. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. we pressed up, I think, 1,000 records, and it cost us, I don't know, maybe $100, $120, I don't remember. And so Merle Schneider was a distributor, and he said, sure, I'll handle the thing. Anyway, we put the record out, and within a week. And the disc jockeys liked me from Little Willie Judd and stuff, you know. So they played it, and like 3 days later, 2 days later, Merle says, "Look, I'd like to order another 2,000 records."
Wow!
And I said, "Well, pay me for the first 1,000, so I can
go out and
get
the deposit out."
Anyway, within a week or 2 weeks. All the people that turned me down, Mitch Miller, boom, 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 boom. Anyway, they were all offering me unbelievable deals.
Uh-huh.
And we went with Warwick Records, which was Morty Craft. It was a new label owned by Seven Arts.
Yeah.
And we're in the first one, because Herb McConnick was a genius, my partner. We were the first ones to ever have independent producers. I mean, we owned the masters. They reverted back to us. We were the first ones to ever have our own publishing company. We produced it, and we managed the act. We were the first one to ever do that because companies owned everything, you know.
Mm-hmm. And they still do now.
Yeah, they do now. Yeah.
Now, how many hits did you have with Johnny and the Hurricanes?
Johnny and the Hurricanes, well, Red River Rock was the biggest.
Yeah.
But I remember one time on a session, Johnny... They were named the Tornadoes. I gave them the name Johnny and the Hurricanes. I like, you know, so Johnny was a leader. And we were in Bell Sound, which was one of the greatest studios in the world.
Yeah, New York.
Yeah, beautiful, great. And we were cutting, Red River Rock. Let's get back to Red River Rock. With Crossfire, the success was the guitar, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were cutting stuff, and I said, man, this is not making it, man. Just take a 10-minute break. So I'm sitting there with the engineer. And, you know, I cut in this little $65 studio. Here I'm in Bell Sound,
yeah.
Which is monstrous. You know? So I'm, you know, and I'm scared crapless, okay? I'm really scared the hell out of it. Anyway, I'm sitting there talking to the engineer. All of a sudden I hear beep, beep, beep. And I said, what the hell is that? So I go out there, and the organ player did some settings on his little organ. I said, do that again. He said, do what?
he went out there
and he found it. I said, okay, come on, guys, get back in here right away. Okay, you play the melody, the Red River Valley. You play this on the guitar. You play the boom, boom. We did two takes, smash.
That was it.
Big record.
How many units?
Huh?
How many units?
How many units at that time? It had to do. It was a number one record. I would say 900,000, maybe. A mil was a hit then.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll say.
It was a freak thing anyway. That little, because they were doing guitar. That's what we had our success with.
Yeah.
And then this little organ thing. And then from that, Bill Black came out, you know.
Yeah. So you actually started something.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yes, I think so.
It must have felt awfully darn good to be able to snub Mitch Miller.
Well, it was more than Mitch Miller. Oh, they're a bunch of geniuses. In
there. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're all geniuses when someone else has done the work for them.
Well, now you come back. Now your offices are in Detroit, right?
Right.
And you and Irving had MB Productions, right?
MB Productions, right. Twirl Records.
Twirl Records. Right. Gamba Music. Was Gamba Music
no,
then?
No, it was Vicky Music.
Vicky Music.
Which is my daughter's name, yeah. So it was named after Vicky Music.
Okay, and now you are approached by a black disc jockey from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Right.
Another sweetheart of a guy.
Yes.
May he rest in peace, Mr. Ollie McLaughlin.
Great guy.
And who does he bring you?
Brings me a kid by the name of Del Shannon.
Del Shannon.
Right.
And I understand that they brought you a bunch of stuff before you finally found something that you would release, and you went through some changes.
Well, no, what I did with Del is that I heard him, and I really liked Ollie. Del was a very good songwriter, and I went in and cut three or four sides with Del. Wasn't happy with it, and I went in and cut two sides with Del and two sides with Max Crook, instrumental things. And he's the guy that got that little high sound on Runaway.
Mm-hmm. Max Crook, right?
Max Crook.
He was a keyboard aficionado, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I remember you showing me that little machine in that studio in Detroit.
He was a little genius. He was in the Bell Sound, and he's under the piano wiring up stuff, and just wiring everything up. And there's Bill McMeekin, who was the engineer. Now you got a picture. Here's a studio, is popping out hits like they're donuts. Mm. And here's a kid who's crawling under the piano, and he said, "What's he doing? I could do it." I said, "Look, Bill, he's hooking it up to a speaker there, okay? Just put a microphone on the speaker." Well, when that thing started, all the musicians, and they were hard-ass musicians, you know. These are guys cutting all hits and stuff, coming up to me and say, "Man, I'll give you $10,000, give me a piece." And I said, no, I don't need any partners. And that's.
And what was the name of the song?
Runaway.
Runaway. I remember this.
Mr. Del Shannon.
As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong with our love, a love that was so strong. And as I still walk on, I think of the things we've done together.
Run. Mr. Del Shannon.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that.
That's
no,
been
don't.
Cut a whole bunch of times.
A lot of times.
Bonnie Raitt's cut that had a hit on it.
Yeah, it's a big song.
Yeah. I mean, and the name of that instrument, I've seen it called the Musitron, but what I remember, it had a label on the front that said Andealine.
That's what it was.
Yeah, I saw that little tiny thing. It had like 1.5 octaves and a band at the top, so you could, if you slid your finger across the top of the band,
it
would raise the pitch up and down.
Right.
So it actually was a synthesizer.
Yeah, we were the first ones to ever cut synthesizers on a session.
Damn you, Harry.
Well. But, you know, so, I tell you what's so funny about that. You know, everybody knew it was cut at Bell Sound.
Yeah.
Now people are booking Bell Sound and going on a Hammond organ.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get that sound and duplicate it. And, of course,
they
the guy at Bell Sound never told him what we did.
What
you know,
did.
Right?
Did so. I understand you had problems with Dell's pitch.
Pitch, yes. Dell was a very, very talented guy, great guitar player, you know. But, man, he sang flat. He really did.
How did you remedy that?
Well, I'll tell you how we remedied that. I kept cutting him. I cut Runaway. He was flat. So I went to Bell Sound, and Ollie says, you got to do something. I liked Ollie so much, I was ready to give up on Dell because he just, you know, he just flat. Everything he sang was flat. Anyway, I went to Bell Sound, and I talked to the owner. I said, what am I going to do, man? I think I love the song. I love what we did with it. I said, we've got to do something. He says, well, he said, I'll tell you what you do. You put... On a tape recorder, there's a caption that runs.
Capstan, yeah.
Capstan that runs the tape. So what we did is we wrapped tape around it to speed it up. Anyway, finally we got him on pitch, right? I said, hey, that sounds pretty good. So we went ahead on and cut it. You know, we went ahead and made the master. And I brought it back to Detroit. And I said, well, Dell, come on in with Ollie, you know. So I played the thing for Dell, and he actually almost started to cry. He said, oh, my God. He said, that doesn't even sound like me. And I said, Dell, who the hell knows what you sound like? Except me or the people here. Anyway, well, look, you know, they put that record out. And within 2 or 3 days, man, they went through like 50,000, 100,000.
Oh, my gosh.
It was just up on the number one on the charts for a long time.
It was a smash.
Absolute smash.
Kind of records you want to have every time.
It was nice.
So you cut Runaway, then, was basically done with Max Crook, Dell, and New York Session Men,
New
right?
New York Session Men.
And on this next cut, you brought Dell back to Detroit and used another group, right?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. You know, Dell, like most artists of the day, you know, when you sign a contract with somebody, you pay them a percentage or whatever your deal is, and it's okay when they sign it because nothing is happening, right?
Yeah.
As soon as they get a hit, all of a sudden it's a bad deal.
Renegotiate.
No, it's not even renegotiate, man. They want out, okay? So what he did is he went out and said, boom, I'm through. And he's cut a couple of sides on a record company called Burley, which was his own label. And a company put it out anyway, and it did nothing.
Anyway, while he was still under contract to you.
Yeah. Well, we tried to stop him and, you know, and things like that. But anyway, he finally came back because, you know, he had a contract.
Yeah.
Fair, unfair. At the time, we were competitive with everybody, you know.
2%.
So anyway, what it was, no, I think it was, no, no.
No, more like 50-50, like the Colonel and Tom.
Oh, sure.
Colonel Parker and
I think we had a 6% deal.
6%.
Yeah,
oh, that's cool.
Okay. That's cool. We paid producers 1 or 2%, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was, at the time, 45s only sold for 50 cents, I think, or whatever the wholesale was at it. And so I decided, you know, I kept listening to it. And listening to the sound with the New York musicians and stuff, and I said, you know something, this is getting old, you know, with the Andealine and stuff. And I had a group called the Royal Tones that I cut some, that should have been a big group.
Yep.
I cut some things on them that were great. It just didn't happen. Anyway, they were going to appear down in Virginia somewhere at some resort. And I said, Dell, I tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go down there. He sang 3-4 songs. And I said, okay, look, I want you to go down there and rehearse. I mean, I'm not even going to be there. I won't see you or the Royal Tones until you get to New York at Bell Sound. I said, but there's one song in particular, beside the stuff you wrote, that I want you to do, called Handyman.
Mm-hmm.
See? So we get to the studio, and they're playing everything but Handyman. And I said, what happened to Handyman? He said, well, and I said, look, man, let's do Handyman. You guys know Handyman to the Royal Tones? He said, oh, yeah. So they're playing, and I said, no, I don't want, you know, let's change this, let's change that. Anyway, it took me about 20 minutes to straighten it out. We cut Handyman. Boom, good record.
Another one, right?
That's it.
Let's listen to it.
You got it. All right, now I got a question to ask about that. First of all, that's Del Shannon, the guy that you said had atrocious pitch problems, right?
That's right.
His pitch is 100% on for that, and it also sounds like he's doubled. So
he is double track.
Is he doubled? Yeah,
yes,
did he double track?
Yes.
So
yeah.
Now we had moved from mono into stereo and overdub capability
right. At
this point. But his pitch sounded great. Did you still have to go to such great lengths to get that out of him?
Well, I'll tell you what happened.
And how did he do it live? Was he singing flat live or did he lip sync?
I think there was so much noise, nobody knew the difference.
Nobody was singing.
But he got, as the years went by, he got better.
Uh-huh.
But the guy felt so sorry for me, the owner of Bell Sound. He built the VSO machine. He brought it in. It was big, really big. You know?
Great big thing.
Big thing, and you could regulate the speed. And I said, yeah. Well, that's great. The next thing I knew, Ampex, they were all coming out with the VSO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ampex is the one, that's for sure. You remember Shirley and Lee?
Oh, of course.
Did they ever play in your theater?
No, I couldn't afford them.
You couldn't afford them?
I couldn't afford them at the time.
You know, because I always loved Shirley and Lee, and this is BluePower.com, and it's our show, and we get to play what we want,
then
right?
Why don't we just play Shirley and Lee
good,
if you're
rock
up to
it.
That? Absolutely. Come on, baby, let the good times roll. My theme song.
Come on, baby, let me thrill your soul. Come on, baby, let the good time roll.
Come on.
let the good time roll.
Shirley and Lee on BluePower.com.
I'm telling you, that girl was on helium. Come on, baby, let's get time, though. Come on.
She was just, isn't that amazing?
That's great.
That was on Aladdin Records.
Well, she had an identifying sound.
She
I'll
sure
say.
Did. They had several hits, and that one, I always loved the drummer in that. Great drummer. Great band. Let the Good Times Roll. Now we're talking to Harry Balk on BluePower.com, and Harry, this record is a classic. I mean, not that everything that you've done isn't a classic, but I mean, this one is, you turn on an oldie station, and you're going to hear What's Your Name by Don and Juan. We got that up, Jeannie?
Yes, sir, we do.
All right.
All right, do you want to give us any background on this, or should we just fly it in?
Let's just fly it in.
All right, and we'll talk about it like a dog later.
You got it.
Go for it.
Is it?
That's you, babe.
Yeah.
What's your name?
There we go.
May I walk you to your door? It's so hard to find a personality with charms like yours for me. What's your name?
Don and Juan on BluePower.com, produced by Mr. Harry Balk. Tell me something about that record, Harry.
Well, you know, they were Don and Juan is not their real name. It's Claude Johnson and I forgot the other guy's name, but we call them Don and Juan. They were a couple of painters.
House painters?
House painters, yeah. They came in. I liked them. But they did a thing called Chicken Necks, which I loved.
It's the B-side of that, isn't it?
B-side of that, right. So we get into the studio, and we cut. And I want to give some credit to Bill Rommel.
Bill Rommel, yeah.
You know, the arranger. He arranged all my stuff. I don't write music. And I used to sit down at a piano with him and hum parts and stuff. And he did it. And he never got the credit for it. I'd like to give it to him right now. He was
excellent.
Great. And we get in there, and we finally get in the studio, and we're doing Chicken Necks, which I thought was a smash. And so we started doing What's Your Name, and I hated the string parts. Now, you got to visualize this now. The string section is the best in the world. They're on all the hits. But I didn't like the string parts. And so the leader of the string says, well, what do you want here, Ray? Now, here they are. I've got 16 or 18 or 20 men in the studio, maybe more. And I'm humming string parts, and this guy is writing them out. And that's What's Your Name?
I'll be damned. Did you ever cut anything else on them?
I did. We'd never had the success on that. You know, when What's Your Name came out, this is a story in itself, a disc jockey, because I love Chicken Necks. It just didn't happen.
Yeah.
But there was a disc jockey in Pittsburgh who loved What's Your Name.
Who was it? You remember?
I don't remember. You know, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, he played it. It went to number one. Went down, went to number one again. Anyway, Pittsburgh had gone through around 25,000 records.
In Pittsburgh alone?
Pittsburgh alone. So Johnny Beanstalk says, you know, they've gone through 25,000. And I says, well, look, get the distributor on the phone. They have these conference lines. Yeah. Let him talk to all the other distributors across the country and tell them what's going on. From number one to number 10, back to number one, there's got to be something in that record. Well, he did that. And boy, boom, it was just a smash.
Oh, wow.
They all got on it.
I'll never forget the first time I heard it.
What?
I heard it on WLAC, Life and Casualty Insurance Company, Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Yeah, from John R., one of the greatest disc jockeys of all time.
Yeah, he was.
He was absolutely an amazing man.
Do you mean there's another John R. out there other than you?
That's right, the original.
There's only one John R. You're sitting right there.
I figured I'm sitting next to him. Was that you, though? Were you doing disc jockey then?
John R., his name was John Richburg.
Okay.
He's this Jewish disc jockey who sounds all in the world like he's a black brother.
Mm-hmm.
And WLAC was single-handedly responsible for breaking, I would say, 90% of the blues and R&B that came out of the South.
That's true.
They were a 50,000-watt, non-directional station out of Nashville, Tennessee, and they played gospel, and they played blues and R&B.
A Jewish disc jockey playing gospel.
And absolutely, he was my mentor, great man. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Harry, now we come to the point in our lives where I come into your life, actually.
Yes.
Okay, now let's refresh. This is now 1965.
Okay.
We're in the throes of Vietnam, just about.
Yeah. I had been working for a studio and record company called Golden World Records.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I had met this group called the Shades of Blue. Mm-hmm. And they had a different name at that time, I believe.
I think you gave them a name.
I gave them the name. And Edwin Starr and I worked on them, and Edwin Starr wrote the song that made them popular. The funny thing was is that I had recorded it on Golden World's time, and it was in Golden World's vault. I had worked a bunch of Sundays and told the owner, Uncle Ed Wingate, the Wingate Brothers of Detroit, to keep my money. Well, when I asked him for the money, he didn't want to pay me. And so I said, well, I tell you what, then, I quit.
I'm sure he was counting on
my
that.
Money.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, it was a real good reason. And Joanne Bratton, who was his, his vice president, said, well, have you cut anything you'd like to take with you? And I said, yeah, I have one master I'd like to take with me, and it was the Shades of Blue master. So I put it on a tape with a bunch of other stuff, and I heard that Harry was looking for songs for Del Shannon. Is that correct?
No.
See, I don't even remember it
correctly. Okay.
Take over, Harry. Okay. We've got to get him some Ginkgo biloba.
What happened is my partner and I broke up. Differences, whatever, we broke up. And I started a label called Impact Records, a brand new label. Anyway, John called and said he had some things. I said, well, great, I used to go to New York to do all my recording. I said, well,
at Bell Studios.
At Bell Sound, yes.
Bell Sound, okay.
I said, all right, I'll tell you what you do, John. Why don't you meet me over at Terra Sherma Studios, which was a Detroit-based studio in Livernois, I guess
right,
it was.
Right, yeah.
So he brought in this, what was it, a four-track?
I think it was just a stereo 7.5.
Whatever. Anyway.
No, it's a reel-to-reel. We're not talking.
Yeah, reel-to-reel. Yeah, okay.
Cassettes or CDs here.
No. Anyway, I'm listening to all these songs, and I hear this one song, and so I go to a couple of songs down. I said, let me hear this other song again. I listened to it, and so I went down and listened. I kept going back to this one song. I said, okay, John, I like that a lot. What do you want for it? And he says, man, I only want a job. I said, no, you've got a job. No problem. You're going to work for me. You're going to do A&R work for me, okay?
Oh, cool.
What do you want for that? He says, well, I don't know. And I said, we came to an agreement on a price.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, fine. He said, well, you wouldn't put that out, would you? It's a demo. And I said, well, John, can you do better than that? He said, oh, heck, sure. Well,
yeah.
Anyway, he put a session together.
With the greatest players at Motown.
Greatest players, great arranger, Gil Askey. A great arranger. Anyway, it was horrible. Okay?
$5,000 later.
Yeah.
It was horrible?
$5,000 later.
You know what? It happens. It was horrible. It happens all the time. Your very first lay down of a song is usually the best feel for it.
Harry heard it. Yeah. I mean, I cut it, but Harry heard it, you know.
So we went in and we took the demo and added a drum and some hand claps and boom, put it out, number one record in the country.
Is this it?
This is it.
I'll be doggone. I got to hear this. And this is something you wrote?
No, Edwin Starr wrote
this. Edwin Starr wrote it, but you did the original.
It's what you do to me, Jeannie. How happy you have made me.
Whatever you want, you can have my firstborn child whenever it comes.
Shades of Blue, originally on Impact Records.
And with original clap tracks.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a rare thing.
Overdubbed snare drum.
Oh, man.
Yep. Right. What was his name?
Marcus Terry.
Marcus Terry.
Right.
And it's funny, on the way over here, I picked Harry up, and we were talking, and I said, you know, there's a couple of guys that actually played on that record, Louis Cingolani and Kaz Kaczynski.
Kaz did that?
Kaz played keyboards on it. He's like 16 years old.
Okay. Wow. I guess he has been around for a while.
Remember Mike Terry?
Oh, sure.
Mike Terry played I think, the little high bells. Uh-huh. I played the tubular bells. And it was really was a demo. I never thought of it as anything
great
else.
Great record. It could happen today. If you put it
absolutely
out today, it could happen. It's great.
Well, but it took your ears to let me know that because, you know, I'm completely convinced that I couldn't tell a hit from a handbag.
Well, okay. I don't know about that.
I don't know.
It sounds great, John.
But when was it that Del Shannon cut this?
I don't know. It was after... I was no longer connected with Dell, and I was up in in Dan Burgoy's office, who owns Bug Music.
Yeah,
and he says, "Harry, I want you to hear something." Of course, Dell had passed away by now.
Yeah,
you know, and he played "Oh How Happy" by Del Shannon for me. I said, "You know something? Had I been there with him, and not being conceited or anything, because it's still a great record, but it could have gone out as a single, if they would have put some hand claps in it,
mm-hmm.
some cute little things
yeah.
in there. It's altogether a different record than The Shades of
Don't Blue. We have it?
Yeah.
You want to hear it?
Yeah, let's listen
let's
to it. What do you say?
Ooh. I have kissed your lips a thousand times and more times than I can count. I have called your mind. You have stood by me through my dark clouds. Oh, how happy you have made me. Oh, how happy you have made me.
I sure wish Mr. Edwin Starr could hear this version of it. I miss Dell. He's a great rock and roll man, and he was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year.
Yes, he was.
And Willie John was a couple of years ago,
right? Yes, he was, yes.
And you're the man responsible, Harry. How does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel real good, you know.
Was he at least easier to deal with than Willie John was?
Oh, yes. No, of course. Willie was a different kind of talent. I mean, Willie was the prince of the blues at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Young kid, just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. How old was Del Shannon when you guys started having success with him?
I think Del must have been in his middle 20s, maybe. Mm-hmm. Latter 20s, I'm not sure.
He was a major talent, and it takes someone like Harry Balk, a Harry Balk, to notice that, because so many, I know I've cut hundreds of records, and I thought they were all hits.
Well, I thought, I cut plenty, too, that I thought were hits that weren't hits. There's no genius sitting here, just lucky.
I think luck has a great deal to do with
Harry. Absolutely.
In the next couple of weeks on BluePower.com, we have a gentleman coming in named Walter Trout. And Walter is a phenomenal musician and a major talent. We've talked about him before, and I think I told you a couple weeks ago on one of the shows that Walter is very, very popular in Europe. Walter's going to bring his guitar and come up here, and maybe he'll even bring Marie with him, his wife, who is a real sweetheart. But I'd like to play something from his Breaking the Rules album. That's the last cut. It's called Watch Her Dance, and it utilizes a rare tuning that Walter does.
What, an open tuning on the guitar?
Yeah, an open tuning on the guitar.
Let's check it out.
Okay.
Music playing, here's my chance. Sit at the table and watch her dance. She got me in a trance. I only want to sit and watch her dance. I want to watch her. I want to watch her. Everybody, they can see the way she moves her body. She's on display. Can she see me? Does she know? I'm waiting for my chance, but she just continues with her dance. Yeah.
brother.
It's party time. It's my man Marvin Gaye. This is a fabulous song.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we. And pick it back. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Right on, Marvin. Mr. Marvin Gaye.
Something about that man's voice. I swear. It's just too darn bad we can't get him on the show.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get a Marvin impersonator or something.
No, no.
That's not like
nobody can take his place.
Now, wait a minute. You said there was a very interesting story behind this, so I'm
there
all
is.
Ears.
That was the album that changed the course of musical history. And I remember Harry was working at Motown. You were running Rare Earth Records, which is a Motown label at the time.
Yes.
And they had moved from Grand Boulevard to that big warehouse on, what was it?
Woodward Avenue.
On Woodward
yeah.
Avenue.
The Donovan Building it was.
Yeah. Great big, huge place.
Yes.
And I remember talking to you, and you were telling me what a great album this was.
Yeah.
And what happened? What, you know... What happened with that album?
What happened?
You had some problems. You wanted to get it out, and there were some people that didn't like it.
Well, when I went to, when I closed up Impact, I went to work for Barry Gordy at Motown Records, and we started. They were never able to get a white act off the ground, so we started a Rare Earth label, and like within 60 or 90 days, we had a smash on a group called Rare Earth.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some hits on, we had a hit, they had a few hits, and then we had R. Dean Taylor, Indiana Wants Me, which was a number one record. And then they needed a head of the whole creative thing, so Barry said, hey, just let Harry go up there and do the whole thing. And so I moved over to the Donovan building, and basically what I was in charge of was the Rare Earth label. And as far as Motown was concerned, they had a quality control. They called it quality control. They picked the records and whatever. Anyway, I got an acetate across my desk on this, what's going on? Mm-hmm. I heard it and loved it. Mm-hmm. So I made, from the acetate, I made a tape. Mm-hmm. Kept listening to it. And Stevie Wonder walked in one day. I had a bunch of producers there, listened to it. They said, if it wasn't Baby, Baby, Baby Love. Or,
Formula, right?
Yeah, the formula. It was nothing. And when Stevie came in, Stevie Wonder, I said, Stevie, sit down. I want you to hear something. And Stevie's shaking his little head. He says, man, he said, I really like that. Mm-hmm. So Barry Gordy called me up, which I never heard from him, you know. I was there 7 years. I might have heard from him four times. As far as business is concerned, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, what's happening with Marvin Gaye? And I said, Barry, Marvin wants to be everything but a singer. He wants to be a lumberjack. He wants to be a football player. You can't get him in the studio. But I have a thing that I really love. I'm going to send you. He was to send it to me, you know. So I send it to him. He finally gets back to me, you know. And people are going crazy. We got to get a Marvin Gaye record out, you know. Mm-hmm. And they played it at a sales meeting. Nobody liked it. Boom, boom, that was it. No, nothing.
The quality control did not like
it. They did not like it, no. Mm-hmm. So Barry says, well, I don't know. He's scatting in there, that Dizzy Gillespie stuff. That's old. I said, no, let me tell you something. That's not old. That's new. And he said, well, if you really like it anyway. But, you know, stories change. When you talk to Barry Gordy, who I love dearly, it's a whole different story. He called him in the Bahamas and stuff. And only two people really know what's going on with that record. The girl who was in charge of quality control was Billie Jean Brown. And Norman Whitfield, who produced The Temptations. I mean, a great producer. They knew who was responsible to get that out.
Wow.
And then there was an arranger by the name of Vanderpit.
Dave Vanderpit.
Mm-hmm. See, so now the record is a smash. I mean, it goes out there. Quality control. When a record finishes, it's over with, right?
Right.
The original record faded right up almost to the regular level, see?
Yeah.
So I called up Barney Ailes, who was the president of Motown then, and he was in California. So what the hell is going on here? You know? The fade stuff, he says, Harry, he says, I really don't want to change it, man. That thing is just busting wide open. Mm-hmm. I says, yeah, but at least snip off the end and do another acetate on it, another master on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Dave Vanderpit was working with Marvin on his album. And I kept, you know, having him come in. And he said, look, he says, I quit. I said, what do you mean you quit, Dave? He says, man, I'm an arranger. I don't need Marvin telling me beep, bop, 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 bop. You know, he couldn't write music, Marvin. See? I said, how much are you getting for doing this album? I forgot the figure. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a $2,000 or $2,500 bonus. You go listen to the doop, bop, 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 bop stuff. Anyway, the What's Going On album. But there's a story before that. I go down to sales, and I say, how many slicks, which is the cover of the album. In other words, you had to order that stuff ahead of time. It had to be printed ahead of time. How many are you ordering? He said, oh, about 50,000. I said, 50,000?
Oh, my word.
I said, you should be ordering about 400,000 on this thing. He said, are you kidding? The most thing we've ever sold on a Marvin Gaye is 45,000-50,000. I said, this is going to be the biggest thing Motown's ever had. They laughed. I had to put it up in writing, you know. Boom, boom. Anyway,
did you make any bets on this?
No.
Oh, you should have. You should have. You could have really cleaned up.
It was back ordered for months. Anyway, it did like 5 or 6 million albums. Just the biggest thing they've ever had.
Thank God for your ears and your victory over quality control, because history would have been permanently changed and not for the better without that album.
So, what are you doing now, Harry?
Well, you know, I'm kind of semi-retired. I do some things once in a while. I did a session with an artist of mine. He was an artist, a good friend, Mickey Denton, his son.
I know Mickey. Sure.
Joey, and I liked it. But I tell you, when I took it out to try to make a deal, the people are so horrible, I just had to turn it loose.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough time, and the business has changed.
Very tough time.
And there aren't any people like you left.
Well. Yeah.
I mean, I haven't met them. And if they're out there, I'd like to hear from them.
It takes 8 guys to make a decision.
That's right.
You can't get 8 guys to make a decision.
No, you can't do that.
Handshake means nothing.
Handshake. Yeah. 1, 2, 3.
You count your fingers.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to BluePower.com. Today we've had Mr. Harry Balk, a dear friend and an amazing record man, a music man from the word go, responsible for so many hits here in the United States and across the world. Harry, thank you so much.
Really. My pleasure.
We appreciate
pleasure, guys.
It.
It's been quite a history lesson for me as well, and I certainly enjoyed meeting you, Harry. It's
really
been
here.
Interesting.
Why don't you hit that theme and let's get the hell out of here,
Jeannie. Oh, my gosh. Is it time to go?
Yeah.
It's time to go. Well, John R., it was very nice being with you as well. And
pleasure is mine, Jeannie.
Jeannie C., and we'll see you guys the next time we're around.
Absolutely.
Very shortly. Take
very
care.
Very shortly.
It's BluePower.com.
That's right.
Keep those emails coming in.
That's right. BluePower.com is brought to you by nobody today. It's just us, because we love you and we love the music. I'd like to thank Mr. Harry Balk for taking the time to come out. And, of course, always my beautiful and charming co-host, Miss Jeannie Cunningham. JC for short.
Whatever you want, it's yours. But next time, let's work on a board that does, that has world working faders.
Listen, I wouldn't know what to do if everything worked, okay?
That's us. From the top of Mountain Washington, broadcast live to disc.
That's right. And I'd like to thank Ms. Margaret Fulton in Mesa, Arizona, who is our new webmaster.
Yay, Margaret.
And an amazing lady. Also thank Mr. David Kimmelman, who's come on board as our marketing director, and Mr. Paul Rabbit, who is on our financial board of directors. And slowly but surely, we're getting it together.
And Bob Drake for his logo.
That's right, Mr. Robert Drake. Boy, comes with a new logo. I'm not holding my breath, Jeannie.
Don't. It's blue is an unbecoming color for you.
Tell me about it.
Unless it's BluePower.com. Take care,
that's
everybody.
That's right. See you later.